Welcome to Friends of Amandla, The Power Within, a special four-part series that explores the authentic stories and lessons from those closest to me, my personal friends. Over these episodes, we'll dive deep into their journeys, struggles, triumphs, and the wisdom they've gathered along the way. This isn't just about their accomplishments, but about the human experiences that shape us all, the mistakes we learn from, the challenges we overcome, and the incredible power of community. A strong tribe can uplift, inspire, and propel us forward, reminding us that every life holds a lesson. And sometimes, the greatest lessons come from the people we know and trust. Welcome to another episode of this delicious limited series where I get to talk to my friends and you get to listen in on our conversations and some of the things that they've really taught me. So this is the Friends of Amandla limited series with myself and Mpeo Nkosi. And today you will meet Thato, my friend with the dogged determination of a professional athlete who brings the same laser focus onto everything that she does, be that gym or her kids or her marriage or her professional career, just her whole life. She's the kind of disarming beauty that you meet and you think, surely God can only make her beautiful. I mean, how beautiful can one person be? But then you sit in her presence and there is an intelligence and grace, a sense of humor, a deep curiosity about life, a person who embraces a place of zero judgment combined with a door that says, what could I learn? She's my sister. She's a daughter. She's a friend who is fiercely loyal and fiercely talented. She can put together JSE-listed company communication strategies, but she can also sew and create. She teaches small kids hip-hop dancing. She holds people's complexity and diversity like no one else I know. She's always sure that she may know some things, but not everything. And in our 40s, she still has the kind of childlike naivety and joy that sprinkles magic into any space where she is feeling at her best. She's my inner child. She's determined, funny, stubborn, brave, learning, a love reflected onto myself. So welcome to Amandla with Mpeo Nkosi.
Wow. Who is this woman you speak of?
It's you.
I can't even ascribe everything you said to me. But thank you. And I'm very, very excited to be here.
I'm excited that you're here and I'm so glad that you honored the invitation. I know how anxious it made all of you friends about coming on to here, and I know it's your first podcast experience.
Yes.
So that's fine and that's great.
But you know, the first of everything is just awful.
It's just in a anxiety, nyana, but it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's fine. You'll be fine because we're just chatting, and that's what this is all about, and getting to know who you are and who you are to me. So thank you so much for making the time, my friend. I'm so happy to have you here.
Oh, no, I'm truly honored. And if anything, just to get a window or an ear into a lot of the conversations we've had over the years, I think not only is it such a gift to be able to share it with others, but to talk about, you know, a subject matter that is quite an interesting one to myself as well. So,
So let's get into it. So one of my... in my group of friends, we have so many diverse people. We have people who have adopted. We've had people that have gone through divorces. We have people who are married, who are single. One of the things that I love as well is that in my world broadly, so in my family, but in our friendship group as well, we have people who have married across cultural lines. Right. And I feel like it's something that's always so fascinating for me, because I feel like it's something that's probably I haven't heard discussed a lot in terms of what it means and what it takes to be in an interracial relationship in South Africa.
Right.
And then raising children, mixed children, not necessarily because being colored is a culture.
Correct.
Raising mixed children in South Africa as well. And then there is the dynamic that it's not even, you aren't married to a South African Afrikaans guy. You're married to a French guy who's been here forever. He's South African. But he's French.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so there is the added component of a language that probably isn't necessarily widely spoken in our country. So that's something that I felt like, you know, having watched your 14-year marriage now. Are we at 14 years?
13 in October.
13-year marriage to Pierre, and watching you, exactly like I said, with the dogged determination that you have, which is a character trait of yours, which is something that you would have done no matter who you would have married, for sure.
Absolutely.
Was to have a dogged determination towards your marriage. But I know that it obviously must have come with its own dynamics. So what was that like, making that... First of all, was it something that you thought, you always thought, ah, I could marry anybody across the color line? Or was it something that when Pierre came into your world, you're like,
So you're right about my approach to marriage, irrespective of who I would have married, would have been exactly the same. And for me, the color or the race thing actually just happens to be incidental, you know. I met a guy who echoed the same values and principles and a pliable mentality in that we will make our own rules and we will bend them to our own will as and when it suits us. And I think for me, it should be true of any kind of marriage. The complexities, I think, came for us when it was outside people, including family, that felt that they had to remind us of our differences. And differences not just being in the obvious color, but the cultural, etc. So that was a challenge that we needed to navigate, but it wasn't a challenge that was brought up from the relationship. It was an outside force that we had to figure out how to work with. Interestingly enough, the concept of black and white, we never saw each other as such. I know it sounds crazy. I mean, we both know where we sit on the color spectrum or on the color wheel. But it was such a non-issue that talking or rather... It was people's looks when we were together. I'm thinking about the early stages of our dating, even now. Their comments or, you know, unwarranted questions would make us realize, oh yes, you know, there's that thing. The families, and I don't know if this is what makes... our blended families as unique as they are. From his family side, the race issue was never a thing. It was more of a cultural and religious
issue.
Sort of issue or consideration, you know. Specifically around the fact that he is of Jewish descent. Okay, so we
and
also
French.
Have the religious thing to contend with. He's not dogmatic about religious practices at all. So his relationship with religion is, I'd say, complicated. But there's still an expectation from family and extended family on his side in terms of some of the rituals and traditions that they have, which we've cherry-picked and incorporated into our lives in the ways that matter. But there's also the nuanced French culture, which is so very different from South African culture. I can give you two examples. One is in the fact that Tato, actually, whether I'm South African, black is irrelevant. I like nice things, and I'm not going to hide my nice things. French culture is, you don't do that. You don't show people what you have. It's frowned upon, you know, but I don't see it as that. So it had been an issue, but I understood it as me just, you know, celebrating life and the things I have in the way Tato knows how to do. So either it was going to be an acceptance of that she is loud in her presence in every way that matters, you know. And I think the loudness is also a key thing in that I am loud. Mm. Vocally, I'm loud. Mm. My laugh is loud. So when I am in, let's call it the French rooms or the French circles, my loudness is not just seen. Mm. It is heard. Mm.
And felt.
And felt. Mm.
So in the discomfort way. Like they're like, what is that?
But exactly. Mm.
And I feel like what you're raising for me, which is very interesting, because I think looking at a dynamic in a marriage where there are visible differences, mm-hmm. people feel like, I can imagine that they've gone through a lot of challenges. But I think what happens is that just because you are of the same skin tone and potentially maybe even of the same culture, maybe Mosotho le Mosotho or Mozulu le Mozulu, you actually underestimate the perceptions of others and what impact it will have on your marriage.
100%. Right?
Because even the cultural differences, you could marry across a traditional black family versus a very Christian black family. You could marry across class levels where there's a certain family that's like, we want to be very muted in how we are, mm-hmm. where the other side of the family might be, actually we're quite open about what we've achieved. And I think there's an underestimation because of our similarities that we underestimate the way that other people can influence the way that your relationship can play out, right? And I know that you and Pierre were actually very clear right from the beginning that we're going to make our own rules and we're going to decide how we do it. Where did that come from for you, from a confidence perspective? Because that was something that you always were before even you met Pierre.
Yes.
Right? So having met you before you met Pierre, I know that you were always the kind of person that's like, I'm going to make this decision and I'm going to do it anyway. Right? You always broke the rules.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't surprising to me that you and Pierre would run your lives very much not looking at the societal pressures and what society deems is good, bad, necessary, comfortable,
right,
to
wrong,
guide you, right, wrong, whatever it may be. Where does that come from?
From myself personally, I think I, when I think about my childhood and some of the things I would do or say, the stories that my mom, my dad, or my sister, and some of my childhood friends would tell me, I coined that girl as the girl who said she can. Stemming from being very ill as a small child and being told, with asthma that is, oh no, you can't run, you can't jump, you can't go play outside for too long, or it's too cold, it's too hot, please just sit down. You know, I was, I think, just naturally defiant about being so limited. And my limitation at the time, because you're a child, is play. And play for me was the space where I could create imaginary worlds, and then being forced to almost pull out of it and just sit just did not feel comfortable for me. So that there's always the thing of, well, just try a little bit, see what you can get away from. And every single time I did, and I proved myself or others rather wrong, that I actually can, it reaffirmed that sense of, I get to decide, you know. I know my own limits. I know how to listen to myself as well. So as much as I say I will, when I say I won't, equally,
same,
that's also, as you know, steadfast. And I think I'm blessed to have had the parents who gave me the latitude. I must have given my mom 1,000 heart attacks, 1,000 heart attacks, because she was a woman who just feared a lot of things. Some of it, mostly of it, actually quite irrational. And some of it was within sound judgment. But she did have a stubborn daughter and a father who was very, and is still very stoic in his demeanor, where he's not about entertaining the, I suppose, emotional ebbs and flows. He looked at life through a very logical, very black and white, very Excel spreadsheet. He's an accountant, but that's how he looks at life. So while my mom was trying to manage the emotional
up and down,
My father was, okay, let's look at logic, let's look at reason.
Mm.
Let her go, but to this extent.
Mm.
So I had that balance of trying at a comfortable distance or a comfortable pace.
Mm.
Well, also, I think in a way, I would like to believe, taught my mom to also let go a little bit and trust.
Mm.
I know it's hard, and I speak of it as a mother now myself. With your first child, you're scared of everything.
Mm.
You know, you want to protect your child as much as possible, even though at that time it was stifling me.
Mm.
So I didn't like that feeling. So even as a grown-up person, the moment I start feeling stifled, I am going to break out.
I know umanganga chumi. Like the most, really, like I've actually been talking about how like a lot of my friends are stubborn. I feel like it's a trait that I'm clearly attracted to in people. But because of that very reason that you're speaking about, like that defiant nature that says, I'm not going to be told what I can and cannot do. And not in the, because a lot of people can also hear that as maybe even in marriage or in friendships, you are non-compromising. It's not about being non-compromising. It's about the fact that you are not going to be dictated to by the outside world what you are capable of and not capable of.
What I am capable of, exactly. And I think that is so nuanced, what you're saying there. Because I can be stubborn about my beliefs, my values, what I believe I can do and what I know I cannot do.
Mm.
That doesn't impose on any other person at all.
Mm.
And I think I've become very good at drawing that line, you know, with friendships, even with my husband, you know. There's just an acceptance of she is who she is.
Mm.
She will let me know what she thinks, but there's absolutely no imposition.
That I you don't should feel the same or think the same.
Yes. Mm. And you might think I can't, and that's okay, but let me try because I don't share that, you know. So these stubborn ventures or these, can I change the word? I don't think it's stubborn. I think it's the discipline of knowing yourself, the discipline of knowing your extremities and the things that you can and cannot do.
Mm.
Live only within my own realm of control.
Mm.
Because actually I can't control any other person.
Mm.
I can give them a window into my thoughts and feelings. And the closer you are to me, the bigger that window is and the louder the loudspeaker is.
Mm.
But there is absolutely no imposition, you know. So when I am with people or an environment that tries to diminish even just that internal conversation with myself about my discipline of capability or rather ability, I don't have that room. Maybe that sounds callous, but I cannot fully realize myself, partner with you, and show up as my best self if I don't have that room
for your own agency.
For my own agency.
Yeah. Yeah. And how has that, you know, we're talking about raising your two beautiful children, and you're right. I feel like you've got two very different children.
Oh my God.
Right?
Oh my God.
Much the same way as I have three very different boys. But you have two very different children, number one, right? From an energy perspective, Lily, your daughter, mirrors you a lot more closely in terms of that defiance.
Yeah.
Right? It's a defiance that's rooted in confidence.
Yes.
You know, she's got this inner confidence that is just amazing, right? You have Noah, who's very much similar to my second-born son, which is somebody who can really read the room emotionally.
Yeah.
A sensitive child. How can I... Somebody whose nerves sit on the outside of them. I can read
he
when
senses deeply.
Senses deeply, right? Mm. Whereas a Lily is a... I sense myself deeply. So... You're going to have to give me clues about whether my sensing of self is going over a line or not.
Yeah,
because I'm just here.
You need to tell me, whoa, stop.
Because I am full of myself.
She's full of herself.
Full of myself. Because I don't think it's something that you instilled in Lily. I think Lily was born with it. I think it's a genetic thing that she gets a lot from you. It's genetic. It must be in the genes. You know, she was born this way.
Yeah.
How do you, as a mom, nurture that? And I mean, obviously, you've given us context of how you kind of pushed the boundaries yourself as a child because you didn't like limitations. But I also know that there are things that I tried to get away with that when I was young, that I'm trying to mother differently, if you know what I mean. Like, I don't know if I could raise myself completely, sure, right? But how do you approach those two very different personalities as a mom?
Oh, friend, that is such a big, big question. And so I do believe that genes pass through to the next generation, you know, that I can see in both Noah and Lily, actually. They just manifest differently. Okay.
They're just two different human beings.
Absolutely. But they're both very strong in their own ways. Mm-hmm. They're both very stubborn in their own ways. And they're both beautiful, loving children. Mm. But it just is expressed so uniquely and so different to each child. So that's the first part. Then how I'm raising them is probably a question I ask myself or I'm faced with daily,
every day,
every single day,
every day,
every minute, every interaction. Honestly, there's no blueprint, but I suppose the mirror that I hold to myself is, and perhaps this is where mothers like us today have had the privilege of being completely and fully owning their identity or who they are. So we know the gift it is to the child to do the same thing. With that being said, though, in moments where I'm feeling emotional, tired, exhausted, and I just want to lash out, like I have a memory of my mother doing, as an example, I ask myself, how did that make me feel as a child? Do I want them to feel the way that I did then? How can I change this script? But that requires such an awareness of self in a very uncomfortable situation in the moment. And I think I can only, or I've learned it mostly through motherhood, okay? And that lesson is starting to permeate other aspects of my life. But I think because of the deep love that you have, you're forced to just woosah, you know, pull yourself towards yourself and say, okay, Lily, being as loud and effervescent and difficult as you are, what are you really saying? You know, when we have an altercation, what is she actually trying to say?
What is she trying to communicate, you know, with me?
Exactly. And also, how do I discipline her? And I use discipline in inverted commas, but how do I change the situation right now?
Guided
and just calm. Make her feel that she's being listened to and heard, but equally that she needs to do exactly the same thing. And I found that it's very different. That approach that I adopt for Lily is not the same approach I adopt for Noah, because it just won't work.
It won't work. And I think I was about to say that, because I think for me, that is one of the most challenging things that I find with motherhood, is every single version of me in motherhood is authentic, but it's really difficult to almost have a multiple personalities in the home. I struggle with that sometimes, because it's kind of like at any given moment I am dealing with two children or three children that require a different version of me, and sometimes at the same time. If you get what I mean.
It's not motherhood, truly, if it's not at the same time.
At the same time. So it's like Wajiga and Mr. Effervescent, crazy, last born, requires this. And then Mr. I want to hug and love on you requires this from me at the same time. And it's just something that I had to be really honest with myself about, that, and something that I feel like people need to understand, that it is exhausting being an intentional parent. It is hard. It's easier to be a bad parent or a one-dimensional parent, because it doesn't require a stretching of self. It doesn't. Mm. And being an intentional parent is really hard and it's really exhausting. I feel like sometimes when people speak and we talk about an understanding of how different our children are and how determined we are to do things differently, etc., it can sound like something that we've figured out and that we're saying is easy to do. It's the hardest job to be an intentional parent.
It takes so difficult. Everything out of you.
Out of you.
But here's the thing, and I have to remind myself where I am in a situation where they're both demanding of me in different ways, is that you are going to experience your children more as adults than you are of them as children. Therefore, I have to intentionally raise people who will be adults who can self-sustain, function, thrive, find joy within themselves and with others, be independent, you know, kind, loving, whatever it is that you want this human you're raising to be as an adult. That's not going to start when they're 18 or 20.
No, it's now.
It's now. But that means that they are going to be a challenge then to you too. They are. But then how do you then create that sense of assertion if they can't assert themselves with you? And already that's going to sound a little bit, you know, if I think about
it. That's a really good point. You're right. It's like how, if you want your child to be assertive, if you want your child to not be bullied, if you want your child to be able to hold their own, speak their mind, use their words instead of their fists or whatever it may be,
the safest place for a child to do anything is with their parents. So that challenge is going to come to you first because that's where they feel the most safest. And if you shut that down, they never really get to flex those muscles. And when they do, it's later through bad influence, etc. And I'm not saying that we have the perfect formula.
There's no formula. But trying your best requires you to accept some of, let them try their boundaries so that you can say, you know, I saw this recently and it's something that has guided me so much in being actually able to speak to my 8-year-old and even to Khotso, the baby, to kind of say, all feelings are welcome. All feelings are welcome, but not all behaviors are.
100%.
Right? And that's actually like as a guiding line, is it's our job as parents to show them that range of all the emotions that are possible, but all the ways that your behavior can manifest in a way that is, and I don't want to say acceptable, but that is appropriate for the situation.
Absolutely.
You know?
They have to function in the world.
They need to function in the world.
Right. So it is a challenge. But one that has stretched my growth too. One that has made me question my abilities to, you know, check my emotions, my demands, because you know, probably sadly, but realistically, we tend to look at children as an extension of ourselves, and they're not.
And they're not. They're their own humans.
They are their own humans. So your ability to influence has a start and ending point. And there's a point where you have to let them be them. And all you can do is just guide with an intention that you have of, you know, the kind of human being that they will be. But it's not one course. There's so many influences during that journey. But the point I wanted to make is that I'm growing so much to them because I'm seeing my own shortcomings. And
we're growing at the same time.
We're all growing together. Like I always say to they're raising me as much as I'm raising them.
The bangers that we raised each other, we raised each other. We met each other when I was 21 and I'm now 44. So you can imagine how much raising of each other has happened, you know. So a last question just around the family dynamic and the interracial, intercultural nature of your family is, I suppose, the gift, the challenge, the dynamics that somebody who's maybe going into an interracial, intercultural marriage, or who's going to start having children in that space, what is some of that dynamic that you've had to learn about raising mixed children in South Africa? Because I feel like it is one of those things that for me, having a mixed niece, is around thinking about the fact that we live in a world where there is an entire culture called the colored culture.
Yeah.
And then you've got mixed children, which is different to being colored. What are some of the things, or have you come up across it yet, or it hasn't actually come into your dynamic yet, is how they fit into the tapestry of the most diverse country in the world?
So this is a very layered question.
It is layered. I know, I didn't even know how to ask the question.
And I think what further makes it complicating for me is that I also acknowledge the bubble that we've created and the bubble that we live in spite of the context of this country.
Got you.
Okay. So within the cocoon of our family unit, my children don't have a knowing, I suppose, of what black is and what white is. They understand through visual cues that mama is a darker shade of what my dad is. But that's the extent of which it goes.
Because and also because your friends are all very diverse. A friendship circle. And when I say a friendship circle, I want to say the friendship circle of the family unit. Right, so the combination of your friends and peers' friends, you know, when we're having a dinner at your house, get United Colors of Benetton.
Exactly.
You know, it's not like they are living in a world where, like, oh, my dad's friends are only white and my mom's friends are only black. So I can see black and white quite
clearly. It's never been a reality that they've needed to question or face. You know, when you present the world to your children in a certain way, they only know that. There's no comparison.
Yes, there's no compared to what. They know what they know.
So I think that's important to just note. And that the fact of black and white is not language or vocabulary that we've ever used at home. Okay.
So maybe let me ask a different question, because I actually don't want to move away from the importance that I feel, or let me just say something that I've admired, which probably wasn't a function of intentional doing. You arrived into each other's lives as Pierre and Tato with already a very diverse world and a diverse group of friends around you. But I feel like that is so important if you are going to mix cultures, mix races, is that I feel like it's very important to not come from a one-dimensional world yourself, because you're going to be bringing children into a world that can't be just black and just white.
It can't work.
It can't work, because you're not actually giving them the tools to walk into the world already understanding that people are different. And that difference is not just in me. Because that's what I'm talking about, is that there are certain people or children who walk into a world where the only people that are different in their lives are them. Do you get where I'm coming from?
I do.
Whereas in your world, your children, the difference that comes from the mixture of you and Pierre is not the only difference that they see in their world.
They live in a tapestry. Yeah, as you said,
exists. I feel like that's an important point, is how much difference will you be able to bring to your children? How diverse and how broad is your world if you are going to raise mixed, and when I say mixed children, because that's so important for them to understand that they are the best of both worlds, if that makes sense.
They truly are, and I think Noah, being older, 10, is probably more aware of the privileges of being able to tap into the best of, you know, what both his parents bring. There was just something you said earlier that I just want to expand on before I make my point. And that is the fact that we were quite intentional around the family unit where our children will have, it's like a quilt. We are weaving a quilt that they can always use as a basis, as a comfort point in defining who they are. Not based on what people are telling them they are, based on their how they look, being their skin color, their hair. Even themselves, they don't look like each other, by the way, as you've seen my children. Yes. So we cannot base identity solely on what you're seeing. Mm. But what we are giving you is a gift to say, you, Lily, you, Noah, you, girl, you, boy, based on, I suppose, how you were born in terms of, you know, gender classification. That could change, who knows? But the point is, no one gets to decide who you are but you.
Yes.
But you. There are things or practices, cultures, traditions that mama brings in. Same thing that papa brings in. You get to enjoy both. If you want to further explore any of them, that's your own world. That's entirely up to you. But it's open. It's an open canvas, and you get to draw who Lily, who Noah is, and who he or she wants to be later. As simple as that. And it even goes down to religion. You know, they know that I am, you know, Christian. Dad is of Jewish descent, but he is, you know, agnostic or atheist, rather. They come with me to church. Sometimes they don't, and that's okay. You know, they've experienced Shabbat as we practice at home. They eat chicken feet with their hands and not a fork and knife. I mean, who does that? You know, but they also know certain foods from, you know, the French cuisine that you just eat with a fork and knife. But they know how to navigate both worlds without it being
a thing.
It's just who they are.
And it's a gift. You know me. You know how I always hop on about the fact that I love people with range. My favorite people are people with range, who aren't one-dimensional in any way. Their interests, who they are, how they show up, just being somebody with range really excites me. So I actually want to go into that a little bit with you now. Because like I said in the intro, you're this person who is a professional, but you also love to sew, you love to cook, you can design clothes, but you know, you write really well. You know, there's this range of who you are, which already we've explained comes from this a defiance coming from very early on in your life, or like, I don't want to be boxed and I want to be able to try things, you know. But there's something so interesting about having range as a person, and being able to do things with such determination, and being able to try everything that you want to try with such determination. You've started a fashion label before. You teach kids hip hop dancing. You know, you've been an executive at one of the big banks in South Africa. I chatted about this with Yolandi when we spoke around what it feels like when you feel like that, I want to call it creative power, that creative power is being challenged, or something that you're determined at doesn't turn out the way that you want it to turn out. And I want you to talk a little bit about the world just before, this very dynamic world just before you get retrenched from one of the big banks, and then what happens afterwards, and trying to deal with the reeling of your creative power being limited. I want to say that word. It's like almost like, you know, this limitation that comes out of nowhere.
Sure. So, firstly, I think before we talk about the aftermath of the retrenchment, my career, my pursuits have very much been in stretching the things that I can within my, my realm of of participation, mm-hmm. be it in dancing, mm. be it in making
just
clothes,
your interests, whatever just you're interested
interests,
in.
Mm. Right? It's always just about pushing, creating, innovating, but with the end goal consistently about making an impact in an unexpected way and making people feel good or making people feel seen. Mm. That has been the common thread through everything and continues still to be. Mm. So even in my former role as an executive, coming into a very rigid space like financial services, you can imagine that room from creativity isn't really there. One has to create it, and when you do, you have to fight for it. You know, but these are the kind of challenges that I'm always up for. Mm. So I understood quite clearly from the beginning what my mandate was, and I was fortunate enough at the time when I started off to have a line manager who said, "You come from a creative space," because I was in advertising before. What you did there, I want you to recreate here. Mm. So I was given the platform, you know, and I used it. And I think for me, it's when you are given that opportunity to shine and show your talents, irrespective of the environment you're in, yes, you have to weave through dynamics that you may not have experienced before. But take it up. Because when you do, and you do it with excellence, you start changing a narrative or a concept of what is possible in a space and what isn't. Mm. Because fast forward 6-7 years later, how I entered and how I left corporate communications is not the same way I found it. Because
so you had the impact that you had wanted to have, which was to change the way that people are heard and seen.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And using creative methods to do so, you know. So when that no longer felt that it was a space for me to continue doing so, now in hindsight, I can appreciate that it was probably time to go.
Yes.
Because my span of influence or perhaps my bold ideas.
You've taken them as far as you could.
I've taken them as far as I could. But the fact that I did is enough for me to say, well, now they have that and they can continue to build on. Mm. When that gets taken away from you, or from me, to be quite specific, it's like falling into an abyss. Mm.
And maybe I just want to take one step back before we speak about that, because I want to ask a question. In hindsight, what do you think is the thing that maybe held you? What holds you back from walking away when it's time to walk away? What was the thing? Because, you know, I mean, like, we've had this conversation.
Yeah.
Like, by the time the retrenchment happened, you were already kind of like, I need to be going.
Yeah.
Right.
And we had few conversations probably about a year
exactly.
before, right?
I mean, we've had this discussion about how I left my previous organization. I knew within 4 months of being there that this isn't the place for me. But I still hung around for 2 years.
Yeah.
Just from a learning perspective of what you've learned about yourself, what was the thing that was keeping you from taking the step out, from walking away?
4 things come to mind. Mm. 1, my stubborn nature. Like, I can't be defeated. Mm. 1. Mm. 2.
Hotlun Jesus.
2, a false sense of comfort. You know, I was no longer, I could do the job with my eyes closed. And it was a vehicle to be able to just, I suppose, do what you need to do Monday to Friday. And
easier.
You know, easier. Not to say there weren't challenges, but it wasn't challenges that you hadn't met before. Mm. So you could...
It was comfortable.
It was comfortable and cushy, you know. 3rd, fear. Mm. Fear of, if not here, then where? But again, in hindsight, that is such a silly notion because, well, the environment already told you that there's nothing more you can do here. So, but again, this is hindsight.
No, and hindsight is 2020, honey. That's why we talk about it.
The last thing, and I think it's the ego. The ego, or rather, the external success feeding the ego.
Yes.
Versus you feeding yourself from the inside.
And I think looking at what's driving you and looking at what this place is giving you. And by ego, I mean exactly that. So other than the cushy benefits, etc., but also the feedback that you're getting from the environment before it started going south. But the feedback that you're like, you're great.
Yeah, but exactly.
You're amazing at this. No one can do what Tato does. Blah, 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 blah. All of that stuff, even though internally there's this churning disc inside you that's saying, it's no longer enough for me.
Oh, it's not working.
It's not working for
me. And it's not enough.
It's not enough. But the environment keeps telling you, oh, sharp.
Yeah, but see, and that's the thing for me that I've learned around seeking that external validation as a means of success. It's so foolish. And it's so foolish. Fleeting.
It's so fleeting.
And it's insatiable.
Yes.
So it gets you stuck in places for far too long than you need to be, or stuck in places you ought not to be at all. You know? And I think because I had time and time again proven to myself that whatever challenge comes my way, I'll always figure it out. I'll find a way to conquer and succeed. I'd been on this winning streak, so to speak, you know? So moving from advertising into corporate, and then you're getting your promotion, and then it's like, you know, exco, and then it's, you know, all the benefits and things. So then you lose sight. Okay, then it just becomes okay, the game of more. But more outside versus more inside.
Yes, you're not getting more and more fulfilled. You're getting more and more validation externally,
but stretched and lost.
And stretched and lost. Time. Stretched and losing yourself.
Yeah.
So then let's go back then to, you're not listening to yourself. These four things are playing around. And the thing that happens, I was having this conversation with Lebo Mbete where I was talking about, you know, she was talking about entrepreneurship. But, you know, the thing that I said was, at least when you have a job, there's like the 25th of every month. She's like, that is the greatest fallacy that anybody has, is that there is any security.
There's none.
In employment either, right?
There is
that there's none. Any security there either.
Mm.
And you are then confronted with this moment where, as it happens with retrenchments, it literally feels like it happens like that, in a snap. One day you're going about your job, the next day you're being called into a meeting and gaga, things are about to change. What happens?
I did not see it coming at all. And I think for me, what makes it worse is that when we were discussing the restructuring of the broader department, I was in those conversations. I was giving input. You know, I was talking about what skills and capabilities we cannot afford to lose, where we could move people, even to the extent of draft comms for the different pools of people. So when you are so
involved,
then you go on holiday like I did for a month and come back, and I'm now picking up where I left off. You know, you set up a meeting, say, okay, so where are we sort of at this part of the journey? And the conversation flips to say, well, you are part
of this conversation.
Yeah,
my dear.
It, like, the wind just gets knocked out of you. I think there's a moment of absolute disbelief. And I think I've been in that disbelief, honestly, for the past 18 months. We've come 2 years since then. Only the past 6 months have I just, like,
let it go.
Absolutely. But the disbelief stays with you for a very long time. And this anger, there's confusion, there's a sense of
how and not just how me
on what grounds? Because
yeah,
everything around you has validated your work ethic,
your
performance to excellence. It's all very well documented if we were to look at, you know, corporate. And
But retrenchment is such a blunt instrument.
But that's the thing. It's hard to separate yourself from the process.
Yes.
And
from the numbers, from the whatever.
Nobody wants to. No. And the thing is, that's
it. Always feels personal.
That's the thing about retrenchment. It's positioned as a restructuring or an alignment or whatever. It's all strategic talk, but it lands so hard and it lands so personal
on the individual.
On the individual. Mm. But at the end of the day, employment, work, it's a transactional thing. You know,
you're selling something,
absolutely, which is your service. And if the service is no longer required, or it can be absorbed into, that is what it is.
So then you get into these conversations. They say you're retrenched. It's a turnaround of what was it, like 3 weeks or 2 weeks?
It was
from
two
that
weeks.
Conversation to you walking out the door of this place that you'd been working for and sitting on the executive for, you'd been there, what, 7 years now?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's the first day. At home. That you're not going to the office. Which is so funny, because for me, I feel like that is actually the thing that makes your head spin, is that quick turnaround. That you can walk in one day, you've just come from holiday, you've just got on leave. Yeah, you're in a groove, a flow, or whatever. And within 2 weeks, now you're sitting at home at 9 o'clock in the morning. And how dizzying that is. Having been there myself, having been through a retrenchment, I came back from maternity leave and got retrenched. But that dizzying feeling of not going to work, how do you start wrapping your head around that?
It's destabilizing completely. Mm. And especially as somebody who enjoys routine as a part of my discipline, that completely rocked the boat, as you can imagine, because it almost was like, well, then what am I here for? You know, yes, there are parts of my, you know, as we all have, jobs that we like or dislike, but it's what you do. It's what I do from Monday to Friday. It's guaranteed. I spend my hours here. I do this. I meet with whomever. I do that X, Y, Z. You know, it was predictable. It anchored my days. It anchored my week. It anchored false anchoring of my existence, my value.
Your identity was wrapped up in your work. A lot of it.
You know, so when all of a sudden you are waking up on Monday morning and the house is quiet because husband has gone to work, the kids have gone, your friends are at work, and you are sitting there in silence, rejected, feeling unwanted, feeling worthless, when you've been so strong and so capable and so confident,
wanted and needed.
And so wanted and needed. For all of that to just no longer be, I can't say reality, but your false sense of reality.
At that moment, right?
In that moment, you are stripped to nothing. And that's when I think the mind, the body, everything that you felt held you together starts coming undone.
Unraveling.
Depression sets in. Self-doubt. And just spiraling into a space and newness that you can't identify with, because I'm a doer. But yet the doer is doing nothing. I couldn't wrap my head around it. And then, as it happens, neither could my body. Then my body failed. It sounds like something written for a movie, where not only do you lose the thing that gives you purpose, but then a week later, it was almost 10 days.
Yeah, it was almost 10 days later, yeah.
The body, my body, that I work so hard for, my body that's carried me through many things, fails me. Broken. And the body, I include the organ of the brain. Where it too started to shut down before the rest of, you know, my body took on the same message.
And I think what's so hard about that is exactly what you're saying, the things that you've prided yourself on, the discipline that you have put into your life, so the discipline that you put into work and achievement, you're the healthiest person that I know. You'll go to the gym even when it's unnecessary, by all intents of normal, rational, you know, thinking for the average person, but very disciplined around those core things. Those were the anchors for why you could have a dogged determination into everything you do, whether any of the pursuits that you have, was because there were three things that you valued: was your mind, your ability to be sharp, your body, your ability for it to be strong. Mm-hmm. So some people who are like, no, I take care of my mind, I study, I blah, 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 but they never go to the gym. You did both. You're like, I read, I study, I pursue, and I work on my body every single day. And then within a span of 10 days, the thing that engages your mind on a daily gets stripped away from you. And your ability to then at least work out your body every day gets stripped away, because both of these start to crumble at the same time.
They crumble at the same time. The brain as an organ, you know, part of the body, took a knock. I don't know if it was something that was just dormant and a traumatic event like this, which retrenchment is
trauma. It's a traumatic event.
Triggered, where then I lost the optimal functioning of the brain that then affected the body. So I went into complete shutdown.
And I think initially the doctors had thought it was meningitis.
Meningitis. Yeah, and the speed of the deterioration was so alarming because by the fourth day, after losing the ability to speak, walk, by the fourth day I missed a stroke.
By inches.
A stroke that we actually don't know what would have happened had it not been dealt with at the time that it did. But in a very short space of time, in a space of like 10 days, I lost all functionality, cognitively, physically.
It was a scary time, girl.
It was a crazy time.
It was a scary time for you. For us that were around you, it was crazy.
It was the, excuse me, but it was the perfect storm. And I think to myself, perhaps God, knowing the kind of person that I am, that he made, he knew there was only one way to completely take me out, not from this earth, but
to make you slow down.
To cease, to stop doing.
And to find a way to just be.
To just sit down.
For a moment.
Was to disable my mind. My body. The very things that made me me. So I was existing in the flesh. But I was gone. You saw that I was gone. It's funny, as we talk now, it feels like I come back full circle. Remember when I told you about the girl that I was as a child? And all my mom wanted to do was just to have me to
shelter
sit
you. Down.
Please just sit.
I go do le fatse thato.
Well, I've sat. By force or by fire? You know how we say?
By force.
Oh, was it by fire and force? So it's quite interesting, just, you know, the paradox.
And I think that what was so fascinating about the recovery from that time, and something which I feel like I want to be able for you to reflect on, is that, like, there was obviously a period of time where you couldn't do anything. It didn't matter whether you were determined to or not determined to. But even that dogged determination was there, like, you know, visiting you in the hospital and being able to walk from one section of the wardroom to the next section. And people are like, no, just sit. No, let's just help. And you're like, no, I will walk to that side. I will do it, right? Your recovery drew on that dogged determination that you had as a person. But there is a reflection that I want to hear from you about that pushing of yourself? Like, there was so often after you came out of the hospital, and obviously it then keeps coming back, right? You know, you're fine, then you're not fine. Then you're fine, then you're not fine. Then you're fine, then you're not fine. And still having to deal, because it was only 10 days, there was still a dealing and a reckoning of this new reality that you had to do, and a dealing and a reckoning with, oh, shucks, this is going to take as long as it takes.
Yeah.
Like, I can't speed through the recovery.
I can't bulldoze over it like I naturally would.
Like I naturally would, you know?
Yeah.
What did it take? What did you have to lean on to be able to recognize that I'm going to push myself, but I'm going to have to do it slower? Or I'm going to have to allow it to take the time that it's going to take? Because for me, I feel like that is part of the challenge that we have, whether it's dealing with, because there was a grieving there for me, Tato. There was a grieving of a previous identity. There was a grieving of a previous way of being that you had to grieve and say, okay, what does this, what does Tato in this new shape form, keeping her base characteristics, what does that look like? And the acceptance of that, like, what did it take? What did you lean on to come to that?
Oh, this has probably been the most challenging season of my life to date.
Mm.
Categorically.
Mm. Mm.
The grief has been overwhelming.
Mm.
Mm. What felt like also a betrayal, work, body, you know, ego. You just felt betrayed by the world, you know. So, interestingly, and perhaps is what is the core of me, whether I am physically capable or not, is that doggedness. The stubbornness to accept. Because while I acknowledged what I was feeling, I was always too stubborn to accept it.
Yes. Yes.
You know? And we had many conversations where you would say, have grace. You know? Take it slowly, you know.
Be kind to yourself. And you were like, no.
And I heard all of those things and I understood it.
Intellectually.
Intellectually, but I could never understand it for myself.
Unosabadli. You're like, and I know that, and when I say unosabadli, I don't mean in the pushing against, right? In the pushing against. It felt to you at the time, in the earlier days of this healing process, it felt like I was fighting with my friend to say, going slowly doesn't mean going lightly. That actually being determined to slow down is where the strength is going to come from, right? Whereas because of your nature, the going slowly for you felt like, I am not going to go slowly into the light, my girl. No. Strength. Strength is what we need at every single point. But and it took a while for you to get to the point where you're like, okay, slow can also be strong.
Slow can also be strong. And for me, it's those, I think of it now as, you know, micro doses of strength.
Yes.
You know, the micro dose of, I don't want to wake up today because what am I facing? You say, wake up anyway and then take it from there. That in itself is just
it's a strength. And that is the biggest strength, goodness, you know. Dealing with grief of any kind, that is the biggest strength. It's just choosing to wake up in every single day and trying again.
And trying and trying and trying. But I think for me, I had to laser focus. Yes. And I guess that's the thing as well that I've always leaned on and has gotten, and has helped me get by through challenging periods. is laser focus. So I think the determination, stubbornness, and the laser focused sort of approach I have helped me zone into three things that were key for me. The one was, first of all, I have to get healthy, not just for myself, but for my people. If I am not healthy, then nothing and anything else actually doesn't matter, you know. And that then further then required me to say, okay, walk down the stairs. I know they say you can't, or walk to the bathroom, you know. And then it's a build up from there. Then you start changing your diet. Then you, you know, you get back into a healthy gym routine. But just getting myself healthy became one of my key priorities.
It's the remembering. We've had this conversation when I was burning out in my career just recently. Was one of the light bulb moments to me was like the people you really matter to, the ones you really matter to, not that thing that was taken, not some job, not some boss, not some, the people who you really matter to need you healthy.
They need you.
They need you.
But how are you going to be not just of service, but what kind of existence and partnership and healthy friendships that are fulfilling? What kind of a mother would I be if I myself am empty. Broken and empty? I had to get
to fight to get healthy.
I had to get healthy, you know, physically, emotionally, mentally. Then it was sitting with myself and say, okay, as I continue progressing with my health, do I now know who I am? I've lost everything now.
How am I? Who am I? Who am I without the job? Who am I without the strong body that belies what it looks like when it's standing in front of you? Who am I separate from that?
Do you know how big a question that is?
Oh my God.
Look, I
for you, Tato, for you, my friend Tato, even before I'm going to say my friend Tato Kekana, the one before marriage, the one before children. Because the first question is, oh my goodness, these decisions that I've made, this marriage, these children that I have, you know, gathered in my life journey, answers question number one. The who am I challenges Tato Kekana, the one that came before even
absolutely.
All of them.
Absolutely.
Right?
Because those are roles. Those are roles. That's not who
this
I
is
am.
Like fundamentally, who am I?
Who am I? I'm still sitting with that, but I have a better picture.
Yes.
And the journey of continuously digging and finding that out has now become an exciting part of where I am. It wasn't initially. It was scary. It was bleak.
Painful.
It was free falling, you know. And you just have to show up as a parent, you know, as a partner, as a sister, as a daughter, as a friend, you know.
But you're feeling lost.
But sitting and figuring out who am I is a gift I would not have had this not happened.
Yeah.
And it's a gift that I keep peeling layers off every day. And I know if you were to put me in the same situation or the same place, take work as an example, take me right back into the position today now, I could not do it the way I did. Because I'm not, because I have a better sense of who I am.
Yes.
I thought I knew then.
Yes. Isn't that crazy?
I know. You know, there's that saying by Dr. Seuss, no one can be more you-er than you. But you can only be more you-er if you know who you is. And I'm discovering that, and I'm excited to find out what the you are is. So then I spoke about three things I focused on. It's my health, discovering who I am. And the third thing is, in me discovering the you are version, not the current, but who I'm becoming, what are the things that then this person is good at and I love that has nothing attached to it that is external?
It's not role dependent.
It's just me, you know, and exploring those things too.
And that is exciting. And I know how that is very scary when you're in the lost part of that discovery phase. But I also know how exciting it is when you are getting to the place of, oh, I'm excited to meet you, girl.
Yeah, I am.
Oh, I'm excited to meet you, you know? I'm excited to meet you because you've probably always been there, but I'd forgotten about you. Or I hadn't bothered to discover that, because as we grow and as we develop and as life, we take on new roles that distract us from our...
Distractions, yeah.
Distract us from our life's work, right? And somebody might hear that and say, oh, well, your marriage or your children are not a distraction. You're like, no, they are roles. They have a place.
They are roles, absolutely.
Right? But motherhood has a beginning and a start. Wifedom has a beginning and a start. Who I am is my eternity. It's my everything. It's who I am in the quiet moments.
Absolutely.
You know, when I'm not trying to grapple with, oh, how do I deal with Lily, or how do I deal with Noah, or how do I show up for Pierre? Or it's when I'm in my quiet place by myself. Can I feel happy and fulfilled without my jobs, without my roles, you know? Because what you went through is exactly a... It's a microcosm of saying if everything had to be taken away from you, because that's exactly what happened.
Well, not if, it was.
Not everything. Yeah. If everything had to be taken away from you that you identify with.
Exactly. Yeah.
If everything had to be taken away from you, who are you? It's a big question.
It's a big question. But at least a question I'm starting to answer.
And a question you're starting to like to answer.
Absolutely.
I'm starting to like to answer.
Yeah.
Feeling excited about it.
And, you know, I'm so happy to finally be at this place, because, sure, it's taken a lot to get here.
Yes.
I'm not saying that I've figured it out and it's all happy-go-lucky. I still find myself asking myself some tough questions and looking at yourself in the mirror and saying, actually, I don't like this about you.
Mm.
I thought I did.
But I don't.
I actually don't.
Yes.
Do you know how dismantling that is?
Yes.
And to say, okay, so then what?
Mm. I mean, like, my biggest thing was realizing how I'd used busyness as a crush, you know?
Oh, yeah, that's...
Like, the glorification
the
of
go-to.
Busy was the guiding... It doesn't matter what I said when I was trying to sound intelligent, but it was the guiding underlying thing of the first 20 years of my adult life, if you know what I mean. The first 23, so I'm talking about from the time that you're in the career. If I wasn't busy, I wasn't human.
Then you didn't matter.
I didn't matter, right? And dismantling that has been very difficult. And like you, I haven't completely dismantled it, but I'm aware it needs to be dismantled, number one.
Well, it starts there, right?
It starts there. And then number two, I think one of the biggest lessons that I learned from Alicia, the show's executive coach and somebody who was executive coaching me, was I'll never forget her saying, the day that you can reframe fear and nervousness as excitement, because it has the same physiological reaction in your body. That heart pounding, that stomach turning, the feeling of excitement, that butterfly feeling that you get when you're meeting somebody new, and the feeling of fear physiologically is the same thing. Physiologically, what's happening in your body is exactly the same thing. And so being able to look at the times that I've felt fear, and she said, if you had to turn the question from what am I afraid of to what am I excited about, it can make such a huge difference.
Absolutely.
And I feel like that's what you're kind of getting across, is you're past the point of fear and you're starting to walk into the place of excitement.
Yeah.
You're starting to reframe that feeling.
Excitement, agreed. But I think even a step before excitement is courage.
Yes.
The courage to let go of what you were or what you thought you were.
Yes.
The courage to say,
it's so brave.
I don't like this about myself. I didn't know that. Mm. I don't know what I'm going to replace that with. Mm. I don't know if it does need to be replaced, but this I don't like. Mm. And to say, be open to reinvention. Mm. Now, I grin because intellectually and even in my heart, it feels like beautiful hope. There's a lightness about reinvention, right? Mm. But there's also the pride and control. Mm. Reinvention, rather, there is no room for control mm. with reinvention. Mm. There's no room for pride mm. with reinvention.
You need to be courageous enough not to know.
Almost like the naivety of a child mm. to mm. say, knowing what I know about myself, the good and the bad, mm. what am I opening myself up to? Mm. And there's a vulnerability there. Mm. Hence, the naivety and the mm. fear and all of that that comes with it. But mm. the lightness that hope brings is what I'm going into this reinvention phase of my life mm. with.
Oh, that's so exciting. And I feel like that's such a beautiful way to close it, because I feel like you are like my own personal Madonna, let me tell you. because I'll never forget, I worked at a broadcaster at the time, and the CEO, it was like a leadership thing, and the CEO did this presentation. The presentation was around like basically reinvention and innovating is how the business is going to stay afloat. But it stuck with me, the title of that, of his presentation. The title of the presentation was called Darwin and Madonna, right? Mm. So the survival of the fittest is in reinvention.
Absolutely. Right?
I feel like in a lot of ways is a real title for the stage that you're in right now. It's like you are living Darwin and Madonna in the expression of those two things coming together. Other than the fact that Madonna is very much a sassy woman just like you. But I think it is so exciting, and I am so excited for what the future holds for you, Tato. And I am so blessed to call you a friend, and I'm so excited by the courage that you've managed to find in the last 18 months or so, and how you've been able to walk through the fire. Mm. And what it's taken, because I've seen what it's taken, and what it's required to be burnt away from you as well in order to be able to start seeing the other side, you know, and to be on this side and to be able to talk about it with such courage. And so I want to ask you some rapid fire questions before we close, to close out this wonderful episode. What's a quote or a mantra that keeps you going during tough times?
I will give up, just not today. Mm-hmm. And I wake up with that thought every day.
Every day. Every day.
Why? It kind of gives you a false sense, but almost like if I choose to sit down, it's on my own choosing. Mm. But I just choose for it not to be today. Mm.
I love that. I really love that. The one thing you're most proud of in your journey so far?
You know, all that's been said and done, I think I'm really proud of this girl, mm. of this woman, mm. and who she's becoming. Mm. And I think I've, at least in my view, dealt with everything with absolute grace. Mm. And whether it turns out for the best or the worst, mm. I'll always look back and say, sure, it was tough, but I'm proud of how you did it. Mm. And mostly that I'm courageous. Oh my God. You know, I think people speak about courage like it's just something you switch on.
No.
But no. To get to live out and demonstrate courage takes courage.
Takes courage. Takes courage.
And I can say that I understand what that is, mm. and I'm less afraid of anything mm. than I used to be.
Than you used to be.
I know what courage can do for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like that's the biggest thing. What courage can do for you.
Yeah.
If you just lean into it.
Yeah.
And you just practice. Because I also feel like being brave is it's an act that requires repetition.
Absolutely.
And not looking at being brave or looking at courage as these massive things.
Oh.
Exactly like you're saying, sometimes just crawling out of that bed in the morning takes so much courage. Sometimes just picking up that phone. Sometimes just going for the walk. Sometimes
micro doses
of courage is all you need.
And
you just keep building on that to live a courageous life. Tato, I love you so much. I love you so much, my friend. Thank you for sharing yourself with me in this way today, you know, because we have so many conversations that illuminate so much for me. And definitely your dogged determination, your courage, your childlike naivety, everything that I said at the beginning about you are the things that inspire me so much, are the gifts that I get to have every single day just by being a part of your world. And I can't thank God enough that we met each other. And I can't thank God enough that I get to do this life thing with you, you know. And, you know, that saying that life is hard, but compared to what? You know.
Yeah.
Compared. All we know is to live, right? And I'm so glad and I'm so grateful to God that I am one of those people who's blessed to be surrounded by people like yourself. It makes the living easier. So thank you so much.
Oh gosh. You're making me cry. I can only repeat and echo what you say. But for me, just even being here is an act of courage.
Mm.
Those who really know me, and I know it's quite contrary to what you see, but I hate talking about myself.
I know.
I really do. So, but I could not have done it with anybody else. And I just love your honesty, your gentle ways. In my crazy decision making, you are one of the first people. There's actually only two people that I call in my moments of insanity.
Mm.
It's you, and my husband has to hear it. So, but I love how you be like, friend, you know that's crazy.
Mm.
You know you shouldn't be doing that.
Mm.
But should you do it,
go.
Mm. And I'm here for you. And just having people like that who say, let her be. And if she fails, she knows exactly where I am. And showing up in the big, the small, but most importantly, the in-between moments that no one talks about, that no one shares. But you're there. Thank you.
Thank you so much, my friend. I love you.
I love you too.
Now we're both crying. Thank you so much, my friend. Love you so much. That was Amandla with Impeo with my wonderful friend, Tato Kasuto.